Hello, this is Patrick Wannis, and first, a very big, sincere thank you to you for attending, engaging, participating, and interacting in our workshop on removing the blocks to your success. The intention of this workshop is to help you to realize your full potential, to remove those blocks that result in self-defeating, self-limiting, or even self-sabotaging or self-destructive behavior. And the only reason that we do that is out of fear. We either think we're not good enough, or we fear that we'll fail, or we fear that something bad will happen to us if we succeed, or maybe we're even afraid of getting too much attention. So what we're going to do in this recording is to review some of the key principles that we discussed and that we learned in the workshop. Let's begin with the first, which is innocence versus guilt. And there was a reason that I chose that sentence of innocent until proven guilty. Because we were able to identify that guilt is the belief that you've done something wrong or done something bad. So is innocence just the opposite of guilt? Is innocence just the absence of guilt? Well, rather than just referring to innocence as having done nothing wrong or having done no harm, let's talk about the innocence of a child, because this is much more impactful. When we speak of the innocence of a child, we're talking about a particular mindset or an attitude or a consciousness, almost a way of being. Now, maybe you don't recall the innocence that you had as a child, but think about some children that are around you that maybe you've seen or that you hang out with, or maybe even your own children. Can you fully understand and appreciate their innocence, the way that they approach life? Innocence, from the perspective of a child, is that intense sense of curiosity, of inspiration, of beauty, of wonderment. So a child will take in his or her hand the petals of a flower, and she'll look at those petals and look at the colors and look at the texture and turn it around upside down to really get a full understanding of what is this that I have in my hand? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? And of course, ultimately, for most children, they want to put it in their mouth because they also want to taste it. The point here is that innocence is what makes you feel truly alive. When you're constantly looking for what's beautiful in life, what's great in life, you're observing, you're giving your full focus and your full attention, you're looking for things that you haven't noticed before. So my appeal to you is, can you approach life from a place of innocence, where you're curious, where you're open, where you want to see the beauty, you want to learn new things and experience new things? Whereas, unfortunately, what happens for most of us is that we just take everything for granted. We stop noticing the beauty of your favorite car or your favorite food or the beauty of your partner. And when I'm referring to beauty, I'm just not talking about external beauty. I'm talking about everything it is, or everything that encompasses this word beauty, everything that makes your partner or this thing special to you. Think back when you first met your partner. What was it that attracted you? What was so special? And unfortunately, as I said, we tend to end up in autopilot, where we're just repeating again and again our basic movements and actions, and we're failing to appreciate all the beauty that surrounds us. Now, why is this important? The more emphasis you place on looking for the good and looking for the beauty in things, the greater joy you will have in life. Because life is lived and experienced through your filters, the way you see things. If you are looking for bad, I promise you'll find it. If you're looking to criticize, I promise you'll find it. If you're looking for what's wrong, yes, you'll also find it. Now, this doesn't mean that you engage in a state of denial. It means shift the balance. For most of us, the balance has been shifted off to looking for what's wrong and what's not working and criticizing, rather than looking for what's right, what is working, what's beautiful, what can I be grateful for today? All right, let's continue with some of the key foundational principles of our workshop. And you'll recall that we moved from guilt to discuss shame. So what's the difference between guilt and shame? We said that guilt is I did something bad or I did something wrong. Shame is, I am bad or I am wrong. So guilt is an action. Shame is a belief of an actual state, a state of being. Now, if we come back to guilt for a moment, it's also important to remind you that if you walk around with guilt, you will always have this sense that you deserve to be punished. What do we do to the person that's found guilty? We punish them. We penalize them. So if you walk around in life with guilt, that means you believe you've done something wrong or something bad, you're going to find the way to either punish yourself, sabotage yourself, or at the very, very least, prevent yourself from fully enjoying life, from fully embracing life. And you'll probably not allow people to get close to you, and you'll probably prevent yourself from revealing all of yourself, which leads us to shame. Shame is that uncomfortable feeling and belief, there's something wrong with me, I'm bad, versus I did something bad. Now, what's the challenge with shame? The challenge with shame is that it leads to isolation and disconnection, as well as hiding and masking. If you believe that you are not good enough and that there's something wrong with you or something bad, you're not going to reveal yourself. You're not going to allow people to get close to you because you say, I'm bad. You'll tend to isolate yourself. You'll disconnect yourself from others, and you'll tend to be phony or inauthentic or hide. Now, it's not because you're trying to manipulate anyone. It's because you're afraid that if they get too close, they'll reject you. So what's the key to setting yourself free from guilt and shame? First, with guilt, if you believe you've done something bad, there's only one solution. Yes, you obviously and ultimately want to forgive yourself, but to get to that place of forgiveness, start off by saying, well, who have I hurt? With whom do I need to make amends? To whom do I need to go and apologize? And how do I make it up to that person? And sometimes it can be simply a question of, how do I make this up to you? Other times it can be a promise of, I won't do this again. I'll do better next time. Then you get to the place of forgiveness. So you want to make amends. You want to apologize. You want to forgive yourself. And also you want to learn from that mistake. That's another easier way for you to say to yourself, okay, I did something wrong. I'm going to learn from it versus beating yourself up. Shame is, or the antidote to shame is to speak to other people and then recognize that they're going to say something to you such as, me too. In other words, one of the reasons we feel shame is because we think we are the only person on the entire planet that has done something wrong, or we think that because we did something wrong, therefore there is something wrong with us. And that's not true. When you speak to other people, you realize other people too have made mistakes. They've made poor choices, bad choices, painful choices. So number one, bring shame to light. That means talk to other people about what you're feeling. And then you'll see that they'll say, yes, I've experienced the same thing or something similar. The next antidote to shame is about recognizing that you're not your actions. So if you've done something bad, that doesn't mean you are bad. There's a difference between the action and the person. So separate the action from the person, because when you do that, you have the ability to change your behavior, to change your action. So separate guilt from shame. Having said all of that, in the workshop, we did discuss this clearly, that it's also okay to feel guilty sometimes, because guilt is your moral compass. It's your conscience that says, wait a minute, if I do this, I'm going to hurt someone. Let me not do this. Or, wow, I did that and I've hurt someone. Let me make it up to them. Let me apologize. Let me learn from the mistake and let me forgive myself. Why? Principle number three, forgive yourself because you're human. And this is really, really important. We discussed it, but it needs to be said again. I forgive myself for being human. Let's spend one more moment discussing this so that you fully understand what it means to forgive yourself for being a human. There should be no reason really to forgive yourself for being human. We have to use that terminology because we naturally judge ourselves. You think that you're bad unless you are perfect, Well, no one's perfect. Everyone's imperfect. Everyone makes mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to be imperfect. It's okay to be human. Now, if you're still struggling with that, think about, how did you walk? How did you learn to walk? You stood up and you fell. You stood up again and you fell. You stood up and took one step and probably fell flat on your face. But you got up again and again and again until you could stand and until you could take steps and until you could actually walk. And then eventually from walking, you walked a little faster, then you started running. If you judged yourself every time as harshly as you're probably judging yourself in adult life, you'd end up doing nothing. Forgive yourself for being human, because we do learn from our mistakes. There will be failure. And the only reason there's failure is because you've taken a risk and because you're human. Let's look at key number four, a parent's role versus a child's role. So I'll ask the question again. What is the only role of a parent? The answer is simple. To give to the child everything that he or she needs to realize his or her full potential. Let's repeat that. The role of a parent is to give to the child everything that he or she needs to realize his or her full potential. Now, what does that encompass? That encompasses food, water, shelter, physical touch, physical affection, love, warmth, patience, understanding, guidance, tolerance, wisdom, knowledge, discipline, boundaries, limits, security, guidance, acknowledgement, praise, recognition, admonishment occasionally, etc. All of these things and more that you too can add right now fit under the umbrella of giving to the child everything that he or she needs to realize his or her full potential. And I'll mention it now, even though we're going to mention it again later, that includes validation and validating what they're feeling. And yes, that's a whole separate principle. However, I want to repeat it here so that it's clearly understood that it's important to validate your child's feelings. And guess what? It's important to validate your partner's feelings and the people around you. So if the parent's role is to give to the child everything that he or she needs to realize his or her full potential, then what is the role of a child? The parent gives, the child receives. The child is there to receive everything so that the child can realize his or her full potential. And we discussed this briefly, that when the roles are swapped, if a parent turns to the child for mental, emotional, physical, psychological comfort, consolation, or even advice, then the child swaps its role, and instead of being a receiver, it becomes the giver. It starts to play the role of an adult. And I'll just briefly mention this, and I know we discussed it. It's important to understand that, particularly if you're a single parent, be careful that you don't make your child your everything. And unfortunately, this does happen, and I mentioned it in the workshop. The clients come to me as adults because the mother said to them, "You're my little man, you're my everything," and then turn to that child for comfort and consolation, and sometimes even refuse to date other men, and turn to that child to try and be comforted. The child doesn't have the capacity to comfort you. It obviously can physically hold you, can hug you, can kiss you, but it can't give you the emotional, psychological comfort, reassurance, or advice that only another adult can. So here again, it's about distinguishing and defining clearly the role of the parent and the role of the adult. The child is meant to receive, not give advice. The child is meant to receive love and warmth and affection and knowledge and wisdom. It's not the child's role to be the confidant, the father, the brother, the best friend, the lover, the boyfriend, or the husband, or the wife to either of the parents. Now let's look at number five, which is, how do children actually learn? And what we realize is that children learn four ways. So let's go over those because this is really important because it'll also remind you or help you to understand how did you become who you are? And we'll be talking about that later in self-image. So let's start. The first way that children learn is they watch. They watch the people around them and they copy. So if they see you doing something, they will copy you. Now, again, if you're a parent, this is easy for you to understand. If you're not, look at your niece, your nephew, or other children around you. Do you notice how they'll just start doing what you're doing? And you can do this as a fun exercise. I've done it before. When I do yoga, if ever I'm in some sort of area like on the beach or, in fact, it's happened where I'm on the beach and I'm doing a headstand on the sand, children will come up and do exactly what I'm doing. And the parents will laugh and they'll take pictures of their child, you know, trying to do a headstand. And it's a great way of reinforcing the point or the principle, the example that children will copy what they see. So children copy first and foremost their parents. And if you had an older sibling, you most likely copied him or her. You probably looked up to him or her because children tend to idolize their older brother or older sister. And then children also copy what they see in their environment. It could be other children or teachers. But first and foremost, children will copy their parents. So number one, children learn by watching and copying. Number two, how do children learn? They listen and they believe what they're told. If mum or dad says, you can do whatever you want, child will believe, I can do whatever I want. If mum or dad says, no, you're not good enough, you're dumb, you're stupid, that's not for you, why do you even think like that? The child will think that they're dumb or stupid and will invalidate their own feelings. So number one, children watch, then they copy. Number two, they listen and they believe. Number three, children have individual experiences. And then they make an interpretation based on those experiences. Unfortunately, the interpretation is always an inaccurate interpretation because the child is looking at the world through two lenses. The first lens is a child's mind. Child's brain hasn't fully formed. They lack understanding. They don't have a lot of life experience. They don't have wisdom. The second way that they look at the world, and this is probably the most harmful way, is through a place of egocentricity. Children believe that they're the center of the universe, and children believe that they cause and create everything around them. If mum's happy, that's because of me. If dad's angry, that's because of me. If mum and dad are arguing, it must be because of me. If mum's sad, that must be because of me. If mum and dad divorce, that's because of me. And children, as I said in the workshop, will often conclude, mum divorced dad because she doesn't love me or she doesn't want to be with me, etc. So be aware that children always make a conclusion that whatever's happened around them is because of them. And so therefore, they actually blame themselves for the things that happen and they create the following subconscious beliefs. It's my fault. I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. I'm not lovable. I don't belong. I'm an outsider, etc. These are all formed in the very early years and they become part of the subconscious beliefs. The fourth way that children learn is by absorbing the emotions of the house, specifically the parents, but even the household has a dominant emotion. Who had think about your situation. What was the primary emotion that you experienced growing up? Was dad constantly angry? Was everyone on edge? Was mum tense? Did mum throw tantrums? Was mum crying a lot? Was there sadness in the house? Was there fear? Or was there even complete silence? Or was it a house of chaos where there was shouting and screaming and constant noise? Children absorb those. So if a child grows up and one of the parents is anxious, there's a good chance that child will end up also being anxious. If a parent was a hypochondriac, then so too will the child grow up and be a hypochondriac. So children are constantly absorbing the emotions of the people around them. They're a sponge. They don't do it deliberately. They do it unknowingly and unconsciously. So here I'm not asking you or suggesting that you deny what you feel around your children. I'm saying to be really conscious of what emotions are you bringing home when you enter the house. And if you need to, then take some time alone to process those emotions and then connect with your children. But be aware of sitting there and either telling you I had an awful day, because then you're turning to them for comfort, or be aware of, you know, are you carrying this anger or this frustration or this resentment or whatever other emotion you have, are you carrying it around with you all day? Because children are going to absorb it. I'll also briefly mention mirror neurons. Mirror neurons is the capacity that we have to actually mirror inside us, to feel what the other person is feeling. Here's an example I didn't share in the workshop. You've all done this. You've sat down. Maybe you haven't sat down. Maybe you stood up. You're watching a sports game. And suddenly, maybe the football player took a bang to the knee and you feel that same bang. Or maybe the footballer gets knocked on his back and you feel that knock on your own back. Or someone gets kicked in the shin and you feel the kick in the shin. Here's another example. You show up to work and you look at Mary and you say, Mary, you look really sad. Do I? Yes. And you don't know how you even know, but you're able to read her sadness. And what's actually happening is when you look at her, you have a neurological ability or capacity to mirror that same emotion within you. So my point in the workshop was, be careful. If you constantly hang around unhappy or even angry people, you'll keep re-experiencing that anger and that unhappiness or that misery, because naturally you're engaging mirror neurons and you are mirroring what they're feeling, sometimes even what they're thinking. So in summary, again, be aware that your children are like sponges. They absorb all of the emotions around you. And adults do it as well, just not to the same degree, because at least we have the ability, the capacity, and the choice and option to say, whoa, no, I'm not going to hang out with him or her because they're constantly angry or they're constantly mad or they're constantly bitter. But a child doesn't have that, and a child can't process what you're experiencing. And each and every single time when a child sees you unhappy or miserable, I promise you, they will try to make you happy. And they'll feel that it's their responsibility to make you happy or to rescue you or to save you, even from unhappiness or misery. So be careful of that, because children, again, unknowingly, will swap the roles, and instead of being the receiver, they'll become the giver. So ask yourself too, when you were growing up, were you receiving or were you giving? For example, I have certain clients who were forced, and I literally say forced, to take care of a younger sibling. So maybe mum or dad said, listen, now that your dad's gone, you have to take care of your younger brother. So this child loses that innocence, because now instead of constantly exploring the world and looking for a sense of adventure and excitement, they feel this heavy burden of responsibility of, I must take care of my younger brother. So again, be careful of the kind of emotions and the kind of consciousness that you bring to children around you and to the people within your team. Let's look at number 6, validation. Now, this is interesting because I don't usually teach this in workshops. I teach it to clients depending on the context. So I don't teach it to every client, but I teach it to some clients if it comes up in a therapeutic session. And yet, this is the one that definitely struck home and really impacted many of you based on what you told me. So let's look at validation. There are 3 forms of validation. To validate someone means to make them right, to make what they feel right, what they think right, the way that they are, even if we don't necessarily agree with them. That means I can validate what you feel. I can say what you feel is right, although I don't agree with it. I'm not going to tell you, stop feeling this. Yet parents do that. So validation is making someone right. And when you make someone right for their thoughts and feelings, you're also telling them you are valuable, you count, you're significant, you're important, you matter. So number one form of validation is simply validation, saying to someone, you're right. And you can do that many ways. It doesn't have to be with the words right. It can be just giving someone fully undivided attention and wanting to understand what they're saying, wanting to absorb what they're saying, and engaging with them, even if you disagree. The second form of validation is invalidation. Now think about it when someone says, oh, this is no longer valid. It's invalid. It's expired its date. What we're saying is it's wrong. It has no value. And there are parents, unfortunately, who engage in this. So maybe little Johnny and Mary come up to speak to mum and dad, and dad turns around and instantly criticizes Mary or Johnny for what they say. And what he's doing is invalidating their thoughts, their expression, or also invalidating their actual feelings if they're expressing a particular emotion. So validation is making someone right. Invalidation is making someone wrong. Now let's look at number three. We have validation, which is making someone right, invalidation, which is making someone wrong, and then we have no validation or lack of validation, which is making someone invisible. So lack of validation means that you're simply not noticing the other person, you're ignoring them. And this unfortunately does happen to a lot of children. Maybe mum and dad are so busy they just don't have the time or don't make the time or don't create the opportunity to give that attention to Johnny or Mary. Now, what's the implication of a lack of validation? I use the word invisible. In other words, the child isn't being noticed and the child feels invisible. Then what do? Because they're looking at the world from a point of egocentricity and through a child's mind, they're not going to say, oh, mum and dad are occupied, they're busy, they're stressed out, they're fighting, they're unhappy, they're worried about how they're going to pay the bills. No, the child makes the conclusion, because mum and dad don't notice me, because mum and dad don't give me attention, because mum and dad view me as being invisible, therefore I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm not special, I'm not significant, and or I'm not worthy of being noticed. So a child that got no validation will go one of two extreme ways. They'll continue the pattern and try to remain visible and never speak up, or they'll constantly try to overcompensate. And that means they'll always be trying to get attention and trying to get people to validate them. So look in your life, your world. First, as a child, did you get validation, invalidation, or no validation? Were you made to feel right, wrong, or simply worthless, invisible? Now, how are you in relationships? Are you validating your partner? Are you invalidating your partner? Or are you simply ignoring your partner? And what about your team? What about your colleagues? What about your peers? Are you validating, invalidating, or simply ignoring them? Both of number two and number three are obviously detrimental and harmful. And in some ways, number three can be even more harmful because you're completely ignoring the person. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "The essence of inhumanity is not hatred, but indifference." In other words, this person's so insignificant, I'm not even going to bother taking notice of them. So stop and think about your situation. How do you respond to the people around you? Do you validate, invalidate, or do you ignore them? One more point on the concept of validation, invalidation, and lack of validation. Give away what you want to receive. If you want to get more validation, start validating other people. Now, what does that mean? Start looking for reasons to validate other people. Start looking for what's right. It doesn't mean you're going to be a Pollyanna or be in denial or live in la-la land. You still want to point out when something's wrong. However, focus on looking for what's right. Focus on building people up. I'm sure you already understand the concept of edification. And also, again, please note that you can validate someone without agreeing with what they say. In other words, you can recognize that that person's opinion, perspective, point of view, or even insight is valid, even if you don't agree with it. And you can say, all right, I'm hearing what you say. I understand what you say. I don't know that I agree with it. And here's why not. But the fact that you've given that person your attention and you've told them that their opinion is valid, that their right to express themselves, their right to experience an emotion are all valid, you can then go on to say, well, here's why I disagree. But your act of validation not only makes that person right in terms of their significance in the relationship, it builds and deepens and strengthens the bond between you and him or her. And if you're in a work situation, I guess even if you're at home, this applies. When you create this safe space and this open space where people can come and tell you what they think and feel, you're going to get the best from them. You're going to find out what's working in the relationship and what's not working. They're going to contribute more ideas. They're going to bring more value to the table because they recognize that you're going to first give them the opportunity to fully and freely express themselves, and then you're going to start to evaluate, well, is this right or is this wrong? Is this appropriate or not appropriate? So there's a difference again between invalidating or saying to someone, listen, I don't believe in what you're saying, versus I don't think that you have the right to say anything. So I hope I've made it clear. Validation is making someone right. Invalidation is making someone wrong, and a lack of validation tells someone that they're insignificant and invisible. Number seven, the conscious mind versus the subconscious mind. Of course, we all pride ourselves on believing that we are truly logical and rational creatures. And lo and behold, that's not true. We're actually driven by emotion. Now, if you're still not sure about that, think about the times you experience fear. Think about the times you experience joy. Think about the times you experience anxiety. Think about the times you experience self-doubt. Think about the times you get really mad. Think about the times you're on the road and the traffic's crazy and someone just cut in front of you and your heart races, or you get really angry and you throw your fist up in the air and then maybe you want to say something else. We are driven by our emotions, and most of those emotions are unconscious. That means we're not consciously aware of what's actually driving us. So the subconscious mind is our emotional mind. It houses our emotions. It's also where we store all of our beliefs. These are the beliefs that we're not consciously aware of, some of which you hopefully uncovered during the workshop. The subconscious mind also guides and controls our heart, our digestion, our nervous system, our circulatory system. So therefore, it makes sense that when we're stressed out, we have indigestion. When we have plaguing thoughts or painful emotions, we can't sleep at night. Our conscious mind, on the other hand, is the complete opposite, potentially the complement to the subconscious mind. And I like to think of the conscious mind more as that part of you, the prefrontal cortex, the part of you that says, wait a minute, before you act out of impulse, let's think about this. The conscious mind is where we try to stop and think before we take decisions. The prefrontal cortex is the executive decision maker. It controls our impulses. And as I pointed out in the workshop, recent studies reveal that if you experience chronic stress, the cells of your prefrontal cortex shrink, and therefore you have less and less control over your emotional impulses. And incidentally, this is also another way of explaining why a person just lost it. And you say, I don't understand. He was always so peaceful and so calm. I don't understand how he just lost it and went so crazy. Well, you probably didn't notice the extreme stress he was going under. And therefore, you didn't notice what was actually happening to him and how he was progressively losing control of his emotional impulses. So why is the conscious and subconscious mind so significant? Because unfortunately, we don't operate enough off the conscious mind. And that means that we make too many decisions based purely off subconscious beliefs and subconscious emotions, which aren't necessarily in our favor. It's important to understand that our mind primarily is designed to keep us safe and keep us comfortable. And yet, we're not able to do that because of things that we experienced in our early years. So our subconscious mind also keeps, it's like an archive, it's like a library that keeps not only a record of what's happened, but a video or a recording of everything that happened. That's why if I ask you about specific incidents in your life, and if you're in a relaxed state and you close your eyes, you can go back to that time and actually feel and see what you experienced. Think of a favorite vacation. Go back a few years and think about a favorite vacation. Where were you? Where are you? What did it feel like? What do you see around you? What do you hear? What are the sensations? And suddenly you're back there. You're back in that experience. So the subconscious mind stores all the beliefs, all the conclusions and the interpretations. And it also stores all the memories. And here's something that we didn't get to discuss, but I'm sure we'll get to discuss it in a future workshop. These memories that you have are like a loop. It's a movie that plays again and again and again and again. That's what we refer to as post-traumatic stress disorder. That means the trauma's over, but you're reliving it constantly. Well, we all have a version of that, maybe not to the extreme of PTSD, but think about a traumatic experience in childhood, and it could have been something small. A client recently revealed to me that for her, a defining moment, a specific memory, showing up at school and the teacher finds these rocks in her bag and scolds her. And from that moment, she makes a conclusion and says, I'm no longer going to be extrovert. I'm going to be quiet and I'm not going to trust anyone. And in her mind, that memory still exists as a constant loop. It's a movie that just keeps playing again and again. And when things happen in our life, they trigger those old movies. They trigger those old memories, and we're transported back. And rather than working with our conscious mind and saying, wait a minute, no one's doing this to me now. That's what was done a long time ago. Instead of doing that, we're actually acting from the perspective of a child who had a traumatic experience. So the conscious mind is our attempt to try to guide our emotions and our beliefs. It's our attempt to try to bring to life our conscious goals. Our subconscious mind is our emotional mind. And our subconscious mind is that part of us that is the ability to imagine, to come up with these great imaginations or imaginings, to do what Disney calls imagineering. That means to combine imagination and engineering, and you come up with imagineering. Well, what kind of life do you imagineer? What are you creating with your visions, with your imagination? So the subconscious mind also works off pictures and symbols more than it does off words. And that's why when we're dreaming at night, we have either good dreams or bad dreams, partly also because our mind is trying to sort out some of the things that we haven't yet sorted out during the day. And it will try to do that through the form of dreams, of images and symbols. And that's why you say to yourself, I don't know what that dream meant. Well, while we're on that, may I suggest that when you wake up, think about what you felt. And if you say, well, I just woke up in a sweat and I was afraid. Okay. In the dream, what were you afraid of? Afraid of falling or afraid of rejection? Deal with that issue in your day-to-day life. Think about, well, what does this fear reflect in my daily life? Accordingly, one of the key intentions and objectives of the workshop and future workshops and work together that we're going to do is to help you to uncover those subconscious beliefs, because you're driven by the subconscious beliefs. And I think you, or I believe and hope that you did uncover many beliefs that you were not previously consciously aware of. It is our subconscious beliefs that can often be the limit, the block, or the obstacle to what we really want to achieve in life. It's those subconscious beliefs that become limitations and hold us back from living life to its fullest and from realizing our full potential. So we'll be talking more about that, as I said, in future workshops and in future training programs together. In setting goals and deciding that we want to live our full potential, we also have to get clear about, well, what is my definition of success? What is your definition of success? And this is number 8, success. As I revealed in the workshop, we actually experience life through 4 realms: mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. Now, if you want to remember that easily, just think of MEPS, MEPS, mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. What does that mean? When choosing to set goals for yourself in life, think about the mental realm. What are the skills, the hobbies, or talents that you want to develop? How do you want to grow your actual mind? So we're thinking here about cognitive abilities, but it can be talents and hobbies, things that really excite you. Then we turn to the emotional realm. The emotional realm often refers to relationships. The relationship you have with yourself, the relationship you have with other people around you, and even the relationship you have with the world around you. We didn't discuss this, but you are in relationship to everything around you, even to your car, even to inanimate objects, because you have a certain perspective, a certain way of looking at things. So therefore, you're in a relationship. Even if that car isn't relating back to you, if you believe, as I gave you my example, if you believe that this thing is so valuable that it starts to control you, then your relationship to the car is that it's controlling you. So we are in relationship with everything and everyone around us. Relationships are critical to our overall sense of well-being because they do so deeply impact our emotions. So the emotional realm is your relationships. What kind of relationships do you have? What kind of relationships are you developing and building? Let me throw this in because we didn't talk about this and yet it's one of my key platforms. Well, we did talk about forgiveness. I just didn't throw this question at you. Whom do you need to forgive in your life? Until you forgive that person, you will always be poisoned. You will always be miserable and unhappy. And if you think you're punishing them, you're only punishing yourself. I'll leave it at that for this in this particular program, but we'll revisit that topic. So life is lived in four realms. Success is defined or separated into four realms: mental, emotional, and number three, physical, and then number four, spiritual. Let's look at physical. Physical is everything that's tangible. We can think about our physical body. We can think about material possessions. We can think about money. We can think about finances. So physical is the things that you can see and you can touch. What are your goals and your objectives in the physical world? Is it about personal health, physical health? Is it about losing weight, becoming fitter, some other physical achievement, running faster or becoming more flexible or stronger or becoming more toned? What are your financial goals? What are your material goals? Number four, the fourth realm that we live in, is spiritual. And again, this is only my definition of spirituality. It can be a connection to God, a connection to a higher power, to a supreme being. And yet I simplify it and say, for me, my spiritual goals fall into the category of service to others, making a difference to others, contribution. And you, of course, can have the choice to say, well, here are what my goals are going to be within the spiritual realm. And they might be about faith and worship and church and religion, and hopefully also about giving back, about making a difference, about contributing, as well as living life from your heart. Another point about goals and success: if you don't have long-term goals, ask yourself why. Now, unless you are 100% living the life you want, usually the reason that someone chooses not to have long-term goals is they're either afraid that they can't achieve them, or they're afraid or believe that they don't actually deserve to have those great long-term goals. Remember the first question I asked you in the beginning of the workshop? How important are you? Are you important enough to set long-term goals? Are you important enough to take action on a daily basis to realize those long-term goals? Are you important enough to actually write out a list of all of the things you want to achieve in life? Personally, I'm not crazy about the term bucket list because it makes me think of dying and kicking the bucket. I prefer to say, these are the dreams that I want to realize. These are the things that I want to achieve. These are the things I want to experience. So again, get clear about your goals and set long-term goals and take some small action on a daily basis to achieve your long-term goals. Number nine, self-esteem versus self-compassion. It's interesting that a lot of people talk about high self-esteem and low self-esteem, and yet very few people can actually define self-esteem. Self-esteem is simply the way you feel about yourself. How much do you like yourself? Do you feel significant? Do you feel capable? Do you feel special? Do you feel important, etc.? The challenge, as I pointed out in the workshop with self-esteem, is that self-esteem is determined and measured only by comparison. In other words, you you say to yourself, I feel good about myself because I'm comparing myself to the person next to me. I feel that I'm superior. Why? Well, because I'm younger, I'm thinner, I'm taller, I'm richer, I'm more handsome, or I'm sexier, or I've got a better car, or a bigger house, or a better title, or a better job, or I'm just so amazing. But the point is that the only way you've come to that conclusion is through comparison. So what happens when you keep comparing yourself to other people? You're always going to meet someone that's better than you in your definition. And therefore, self-esteem is a very, very fragile thing. In fact, I view it as sometimes being dangerous. It doesn't mean that I don't teach people to have high self-esteem. I encourage them to be aware of how are you measuring self-esteem? Are you comparing yourself to yourself, or are you comparing yourself to others? Are you comparing yourself with people that you perceive to be as perfect? So again, the danger, the concern with self-esteem is that you are constantly comparing yourself. And usually these comparisons haven't even been really defined by you. They've been defined by society. Society has said, for you to be great, for you to be special, for you to have high self-esteem, you must be young, you must be healthy, you must look this way, you must dress this way, you must talk this way, you must drive this car, you must have this kind of job, you must have this kind of house, you must have this amount of money, and you got to dress this way today because this is the fashion style, and make sure you don't have any wrinkles, and make sure your hair is nice and glossy and shiny, get the right perm or the right straightening, make sure you got highlights, etc. Now, if you're a woman, then you really understand what I'm talking about, because there's a lot more pressure placed on women. And so be careful of comparing yourself constantly to other people and ask yourself, by what do I measure my importance, my significance, and my value? Do I choose to use only society's standards? And those standards change constantly. And if they do, you're always going to be manipulated and controlled by society and whatever society deems to be valuable. Now let's compare self-esteem with self-compassion. So self-esteem is basically how much you like yourself, and it's measured by comparing yourself to other people. Let's contrast that with self-compassion. First, what is compassion? Well, for us to understand compassion, let's look at empathy, sympathy, and then compassion. Sympathy is when you basically have pity on someone. You know, we extend our deepest sympathies to someone's loss. But sympathy tends to be from a place of looking down upon someone because they're in a worse place than us. Empathy is at eye level. It's almost equal. I feel your pain. I understand what you're going through. Compassion is feeling that person's pain and then wanting to relieve it. So compassion is much more than that, much more than just either looking down at someone like sympathy or empathy being at the same level. Compassion is, I want to lift you up out of this place. I'm not looking down at you. I'm not just at your level. I might get down to your level so I can feel that pain, have the empathy, and then I want to lift you up out of this deep, dark place. So the question is, well, how do you engage self-compassion? What is self-compassion? Compassion is feeling the pain and wanting to relieve it. So when we're talking about self-compassion, it's about feeling your own pain, not denying it, not judging it, not blaming yourself for feeling it, but accepting, I am in pain right now. I feel sad. I feel unhappy. I feel disappointed. I feel miserable. I feel hopeless. And then saying, okay, what can I do to relieve this pain? Sometimes it's taking action, and sometimes it's simply being patient with yourself. Maybe you did make a mistake and there are consequences and you feel sad about that. You feel sad because maybe you lost a certain component in a relationship you once had. Can you have compassion for yourself? Can you say, it's okay that I feel sad. It's okay that I made that mistake. I'm going to do something about it. It's okay to be human. So again, as I mentioned a moment before, compassion is about being on the same level as the other person and then lifting them up from that deep, dark place. So self-compassion is also about lifting yourself up from that deep, dark place, from the painful place, but without judging yourself or beating yourself up and without placing more pressure on yourself. The idea is to be patient, kind, understanding, warm, tolerant, and even encouraging towards yourself so that you can engage in self-compassion. We have two more key principles to review from our workshop, and number 10 is self-image. Now, I know this was a surprise for many people when I gave you the exercise to actually write out, what is your self-image? How do you see yourself? How do you define yourself? This is the image that you create, and you say, I'm tall, I'm handsome, I'm sexy, I'm young, I'm powerful, or whatever you wrote down in that description. Now, interestingly about self-image, something that we didn't get to discuss, is once we create a self-image, we'll work very hard to try to maintain that self-image. So the question is, the self-image you have right now, is that the self-image you want? Do you want to keep maintaining that image, or do you want to shift it? The next question as it pertains to self-image is, how did you get this self-image? How did you form it? How did you formulate it? Who shaped it? Of course, we like to think, hey, I did it all on my own. But as I pointed out, no, a lot of it was done for you. As a couple of people in the workshop said, it was the result of things that people said. If someone tells you you're smart or you're tall or you're sexy or you're great or you're wise, then that also forms part of your self-image. So how was your self-image formed? Obviously, and hopefully you made some of that self-image consciously, or you formed it consciously. But what about your parents? How did they form your self-image, or even your siblings or other people around you, maybe your grandmother, your grandfather? So we did this in the class. You can always do it again if you like. Even if you're driving in, just think, whilst being very alert on the road, what were some of the qualities that my mother or father had? So if you wrote down in the class one parent, write down now the other parent. And if you need to write it, then stop, obviously. Stop and pull over to the side of the road and write it out. So write out the other parent. What were the qualities of the other parent? Now go back and compare those qualities with the qualities that you've listed in your self-image. How do they compare? Also, and I don't think we did this together, what about the emotions? In your self-image, what emotions do you add to that list? What emotions do you see that form your self-image? Is it charismatic? Is it bright? Is it vibrant? Is it sexy? What emotions do you give to yourself? Now, think about the emotions of your parents. Which emotions did you unknowingly or unwittingly, or maybe even consciously, adopt? So if you look at the description you made for your parents, and you look at the description you gave for yourself, your self-image, how do they compare? How much did you adopt from your parents? And I pointed this out to say that no matter how good or bad your parents were, you did adopt some of their qualities. You have to make the decision, are these the qualities I want to continue to develop and cultivate? So I gave the example of my father, who was actually very, very abusive, but he had some other great qualities. He was generous. He was hospitable. At times he could be quite funny, although he wasn't that around me, but he was that around my other brothers. And he also taught me about justice. And he was also a perfectionist. He believed that everything had to be done perfectly. I adopted the good and the bad. I didn't end up becoming abusive, but I ended up placing a focus on justice, on right and wrong, ended up being generous and hospitable. And the other thing that I adopted from him, and it took me a long time to choose to accept this, he had a passion for music, music from all over the world. Lo and behold, I too had a passion for music, but I refused for decades to ever accept that it came from him. I didn't even stop to think that it could have come from him, because I wanted to believe that I am my own person. I'm completely autonomous and I owe nothing to anyone. I never want to be like my mother. I never want to be like my father. And yet the truth is that we are like them. We do inherit certain qualities, traits, and characteristics. And if you believe you've inherited some that are not healthy for you or are disempowering, then work on changing those qualities, those traits, or those characteristics. But embrace the others. Embrace the good. And when you do that, you feel better about yourself because you're actually learning to accept yourself. And when you're honest with yourself, what did you really want from your mother and father? Of course, you're going to say love, but love included acceptance and approval. But if you're denying that you have any similarities to them, then you're actually rejecting yourself. Instead of giving yourself approval, you're rejecting yourself. Instead of accepting yourself, you're rejecting yourself. When I got to that place of saying, wow, I really am like my mother in so many ways, and I am like my father in so many ways, I felt really good. I actually felt better about myself, and suddenly I wasn't in denial. And then, through the appropriate work and the appropriate processes, you end up admitting to yourself, well, what I really wanted was their love. I wanted their love and I wanted their approval. Doesn't matter how much I say, I'll never be like them. I don't want anything from them. I don't want anything to do with them. What every child wants is love. Love, acceptance and approval and so many other things, of course, acknowledgement, praise, recognition, belonging. But the child wants all of that from his or her father and mother. And here is principle or key foundation number 11. The law of deservedness. As I said, I coined this phrase as a result of observation of clients and even other people in public. So it was back in about 2006 that I noticed so many celebrities sabotaging themselves. I noticed it with people like Michael Vick and footballers and various singers and other athletes and actresses. And I said, these people are constantly sabotaging themselves. Why? Why are they doing this? Then I noticed too that my clients were doing it. And I noticed that women would get themselves in this relationship after relationship where they were constantly being mistreated or controlled or even abused. And then men were getting themselves in these business situations where they were constantly turning out to be lemons. They were having these constant failures. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. Why are people constantly sabotaging themselves? And I referred to this as the law of deservedness because what I discovered was that we have subconscious beliefs about what we believe we deserve. So let me state that again clearly. We have a belief about what we deserve. And it's not just a belief, it's an emotion attached to it. So my question to you is, what do you feel and believe you deserve in life? Now, if you just automatically say, oh, the very best, perhaps you're not thinking sufficiently deeply. What were you told as a child about what you deserve? What was done to you as a child, which impacted what you believe about your self-worth? And here's another one. What was not done to you as a child, which therefore impacted your belief about your self-worth? So there are things in childhood that we wanted our parents to do, and there are things that our parents didn't do. So in other words, there are things our parents did to us, but there are also things they failed to do. Maybe they failed to give you more attention or more praise or more approval, or they failed to give you more time, or they failed to show up to your important events, or maybe they failed to validate you. So there are things that we wanted our parents to do, and there are things that we didn't want our parents to do. But collectively, they unfortunately form beliefs about our self-worth. And yet the truth is, and this is, we're going to do more work on this in future workshops, I know we will, it's not your fault. Your mum and dad were who they are, or are who they are, because of things that happened to them when they were children, long before you were even thought of. That's easy to say consciously, but to understand that subconsciously is very different. And I can tell you from my experience with clients and even my own personal experience, if you experience things such as abuse or being mistreated or not being validated or being invalidated or being ignored or being criticized, condemned, judged, beaten, etc., you end up thinking there must be something wrong with me. Why else would my parents be doing this? And again, the only truth that exists is it had nothing to do with you. And you also need to be careful of the question, why me? When you ask the question, why me, it's coming from the place that you subconsciously believe that you contributed to or caused what was done to you or not done to you by your parents. So think about this carefully, because sometimes things are random. Now, you might have some other beliefs that might shift that if you believe in reincarnation or you have some other spiritual or religious beliefs. Nonetheless, come from this perspective that it's not about you. Your parents didn't deliberately pick you out to either ignore you or to hurt you or to abuse you. You were there. Now, for me, it became a little bit easier because I saw it also done to my eldest brother. He was 1 year older than me, so we were pretty close. We both experienced the abuse. 12 years later, my mother has another child. Same mother and father, has another child, and then 3 years after that, another child. They didn't experience it to the same extent because by that time, my father had changed. He'd become older. So again, be careful of asking that question, why me? Because you might not be able to get that very clear answer you're looking for. The easiest way to understand this is that your parents are who they are because of what they experienced in their childhood and because of the way they were programmed. So let's spend a few more minutes talking about the law of deservedness, because I haven't yet fully defined it for you. I explained that I came up with this terminology, or I described this phenomena of people sabotaging themselves, because I realized that at a subconscious level, they didn't believe they deserved to have the success that they had or were experiencing. And it wasn't sort of like there's one limit. There was different levels of deservedness. So what I found was, and I put it this way, the law of deservedness states that you only get what you subconsciously feel and believe you deserve and no more. If you get more than what you subconsciously feel and believe you deserve, you'll sabotage it, you'll push it away, or you simply won't enjoy it. So think about it in your life. Has there been times where you've really sabotaged your own success, your own sense of joy, your own sense of happiness? Were you doing it so that someone else wouldn't feel so bad? Were you doing it because you didn't feel you deserved that success? Again, from where does that come? So the idea of the work that we're going to keep doing together is to raise your level of deservedness so that you can truly and subconsciously feel and believe that you are worthy, you are good enough, you do deserve the best in life, that you deserve all that life has to offer, that you deserve to realize your full potential. And how do we get to those places? Forgiveness is a key component. So is self-compassion. So is empathy. So is mindfulness. So is emotional intelligence. So too is the psychological capital that Shell teaches. Starting off with optimism. Optimism is something that I talked about earlier. Connect optimism with the innocence of children. How they always look for the good and they always believe in possibilities. You can't tell a child no. Unfortunately, too many parents do. The child goes, yes, yes, I can, I can, I can, I can. The child doesn't accept that they can't do it. Except in those few rare moments where they get frustrated. They go, Mommy, I can't button up my shirt. So optimism is the first pillar. The second is resiliency. Remember I said in the workshop that yes, at times life isn't fair. And yes, part of the human experience is suffering and disappointment. But are you resilient enough to bounce back? And that's what resiliency is. It's about bouncing back. Remember in the video, it was Sylvester Stallone's character, Rocky Balboa, and even the Vice Admiral, who both were talking about how you're going to get hit. You're going to get hit. You're going to get pounded. You're going to fall to the ground. But can you get back up? Can you get back in the ring? That's about resiliency. The third pillar is hope. There's always hope, and hope is probably one of the most powerful human emotions we have. Because hope always says, I can come back. I can do this. There's still good around the corner. There's still beauty left in the world. There's still greatness in the world. There's still an opportunity for me to live life to its fullest. That is hope. And then the final one is self-efficacy. And we'll be talking a lot more about this in future workshops, because this is about believing in your own abilities, about believing in your own talents, as well as believing you actually deserve the success that your heart desires. And remember the two key principles I taught about self-confidence? Number one, you've done it before, so you can most likely do it again. But let's say you haven't done it before, then what? Then you say to yourself, no matter what happens, I'll be okay. So again, thank you very much for being part of this fantastic workshop. It's the first of many to come, hopefully. I will be creating more modules such as this, so when you are stuck in that traffic, you can actually be listening to this and learning from it. Please make some notes too of questions you have, because as we're going to be working together, I'm looking forward to answering those questions for you and helping you. Because my only role here is not just to be a coach, not just to be a guide, but to be someone who shares those insights, shares those messages, shares that wisdom, so that you can truly realize your full potential. So you can let go of all of that old self-defeating, self-limiting, self-sabotaging, or self-destructive behavior. And instead, you can live life to its fullest, because you do truly deserve the best. From Patrick Wannis, thank you so much for giving me your time and your attention. Thank you, and I wish you all the best.